You are tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today I have a special show because I will be doing an interview with a singer and songwriter named Doug Jones, who recorded in a group from Chicago and recorded outside of Chicago and had a long musical career. So we'll be talking about his career and playing his music. So first of all, Doug, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. So first of all, thanks so much for being on the phone and telling your story. So
thank you for inviting me.
So first of all, I guess the first group that you recorded with was a group called The Divines. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can we talk about what part of Chicago you're originally from?
The South Side.
Like what blocks from the South Side are you from?
96 and King Drive and Princeton Park.
Okay. And how did you get involved with music originally?
Originally, I got involved by following my brother and Greg Fowler around. They had a group, the Amazing Jazz Quartet or the Exotic Five. That was the Exotic Five. Okay, and I'll never forget the talent show they did at the Burnside Elementary School. And my brother was a drummer, and Greg was playing trumpet at the time. And they had a couple other horn players and a keyboard player. And, I got off on, just watching them groove. And I said, I'd like to, be a part of something like that. So I got into learning different instruments in the band, and it was going fine, but I always did write a lot of poetry, or what became lyric now, and that's how I got started.
So was that a jazz group that your brother and Greg Fowler were
in?
Yeah,
it was a jazz group.
How old were they when you were watching them?
Oh my God, they were probably my brother and I are 3 years apart, and he was probably 14, 15, 16.
And
I was 3 years younger than that.
And Greg Fowler is famous for writing songs for and putting together a lot of the harmony for the Five Stair Steps. Is that right?
Yes.
And are you related to Greg?
He's my cousin.
Okay. So you were around while the Five Stair Steps were coming up, and I know you're from Princeton Park, so you're from like the same area. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. So they were playing jazz. Were you into jazz at the time too?
I was into music, period. All types of music, jazz, classical, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, whatever attracted my ear, that's what I was into.
Okay. So when did you first, you said you started playing an instrument yourself? You started playing instruments yourself?
Well, I was taking different instruments in the band. I started out with trumpet. And after about 6 months of that, I said, no, this is not for me. And then I went to tenor sax, played that for a while. And I said, now I want to get into something else. And I got into an upright bass, which is a funny thing. My mother used to come out to the school and pick me up. I was going to Luther South at the time, my first year of high school. And I put this big upright, I bring this big upright bass out of the school, first of all, and she sees that she's got to put this in her car in the snow. And so we get it in the car and we get it home, and I'm in the basement, and I'm just fiddling around, trying to get the feel for it. And I went from the upright bass to piano, which I should have stayed at all the time, and that's what I play at right now. But I tried several other instruments also. I never got to a bassoon, though, and I never got to a piccolo.
Okay.
But I'm still willing to try it.
So you rotated through most of the musical instruments.
Oh yeah.
So how did you get into singing?
I got into singing. Chico and I knew each other, you know, from the streets of from 95th Street, and I used to always go up on 95th Street around the pool hall, which is where you could find a lot of the guys hanging around, just standing on the corner singing doo-wop harmony and doo-wop songs. And Greg used to teach a lot of the guys different songs. He and another guy named Donald Thomas, who was a guitar player, who got Greg started playing guitar. And I got into, you know, listening to their harmonies, and then I they'd give me a note to sing, and I would be able to hold a note, so they, you know, make me stand in, and I'd be singing like first center or something, because my range was very high at the time, and from that, I just continued on.
So,
and later, Chico and I, we started going to his house writing songs together, and we went to a studio downtown on Wabash called MBS. I'll never forget. Fred Robinson owned it, and we made a demo, and we heard ourselves on this wax, and we said, "Yeah, that sounds good. You know, we need to put a couple more voices in there." And I knew Mildred from school, Mildred Bullard, and he and Chico and Paul used to come over to Chico's house a lot when we'd be over writing songs. So we just started singing together and decided to put a group together. And next thing you know, the four of us are singing as a group. And here comes a guy, Mildred's uncle, Jerry, and he's looking for a group to manage. And he named us the Divines. And we were doing talent shows and different things around the city. And he decided that he wanted to take us in the studio to record. And that's when we went in and recorded. The first song was, I think, Lover's Island. And We're Gonna Make It. And a couple of other songs we did.
So do you remember what year that was?
My God. Oh, you're talking about back in the 60... What is it, 67, maybe 66?
Okay.
About 65, between 65 and 67, somewhere in that area.
So did you all knew...
Don't make me date myself.
You all knew each other from high school, pretty much?
Well, we knew each other not only from high school, but from the neighborhood as well.
And so the member... Can you repeat who the members of the Divines were and who their first and last names were and what part each person sang?
Okay, it was Chico, who was Perry Wright, and Chico sang tenor, and he sang lead, mostly, and played piano. There was Mildred Billard, who sang alto, and she sang tenor. And Paul Combs, I believe Combs was his last name, and myself, Doug Jones, and I sang tenor. And Paul was also a tenor. Paul was the first tenor. And I was the first tenor, and we would switch off from first to second, depending on the songs.
And so you met this guy named Jerry Jones, and he recorded you, and he released...
Well, Mildred, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, but, no, go ahead, sorry.
Jerry was Mildred's uncle, and he brought her to rehearsal one day, and he came in to hear the group, and... she said that he was looking for a group, that he wanted to start a record label and et cetera. And he heard us sing a few songs, and he wanted to manage us. And he said that he would get us gigs and do this, that, and the other. You know, always the promise of the big blue sky, you know.
Okay.
And we went along with it. And like I said, he's the one that gave us the name The Divines. And that's how Paul started.
And the record label he released you on, it was called AOA. Did that stand for something?
Actors of America.
Do you know what that – did that mean anything to you or to him?
To him it did.
Okay.
To me it didn't mean anything. It was just a record label name. But for him it meant something because he was an actor himself.
Oh, actor. It's for Actors of America, you're saying?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. So he was an actor trying to break through, so AOA was Actors of America. So that's interesting. Okay. So let me play the record and we could talk some more. So there were two sides to the record. One was Lover's Island and one was I Gotta Make It. What was the A side of the record?
Lover's Island was supposed to be the A side.
Okay. So let me play Lover's Island and then we could talk some more. So
okay. This
is the Divines with Lover's Island. Okay, that was just the Divines with their very first record called Lover's Island. And if you're just tuning in, I have Doug Jones, member of the Divines, and we are talking about his music and his records. So that record, it came out around 1966, 1967, is that right?
Or 65.
Okay.
Somewhere in there.
One of those 3 years. So could you talk a little bit about the recording session? Like, do you remember where it was recorded?
Yeah. Well, we rehearsed at Robert Cho Lounge down on 67th and King Drive, I think it is. And we recorded at Wonderful Studios. And we used a smaller room that they had. We didn't have the budget to go into a larger room. And one of the primary musicians we had was Marshall from Marshall and the Shalites, Marshall Thompson. And Marshall also produced Lover's Island and The Flip Side, We're Gonna Make It.
And Marshall, he was a drummer, right? He played drums on a lot of people's records.
He was a drummer, right. He was the drummer on the session.
And so that record, did it get any play in Chicago?
It got very little play. There was a station, Bill Kenner, disc jockey I remember very well. Very clean-cut guy and very professional. He was a disc jockey out at WBEE. And he used to play Lover's Island.
Okay.
But the other stations, we didn't hear it too much.
Yeah, Lover's Island, it had like a throwback kind of doo-wop almost sound.
Yes.
And then the other side had like a more modern kind of sound.
Yeah, very much more updated.
And on that record, another question is... Jerry Jones had started another record label, and you were telling me that you sang on backup for the artist on his other record label, too. Is that right?
So Chico and I did a couple of background parts on the other record for the Venturers, and Chico played piano on their session.
Okay. So the other record label he had, it was called Green Light Records.
Right.
And the Venturas record was Calling You Baby and Heart of Love. So you're saying you and Perry Wright both sing on that record.
Yeah, we sang background parts on there.
So by that... Sorry.
Calling You Baby and Heart of Love.
By that time, were you going to Harlan High School?
Yes.
So you had...
I transferred from Lupa South and I was in Harlan High School.
So would you say that Greg Fowler was like a force in kind of putting together a lot of the groups that were going to Harlan at that time?
Very much so. Greg Fowler was an inspiration to a lot of the entertainment that came out of that area. He had the patience to teach you the harmonies and teach you the songs, and he had the tenacity to see it through. And, you know, if you didn't fit the part, he wouldn't hang on to you. You know, he'd tell you, he'd say, you know, you just shut up. but if you had it, you know, he worked it.
And with you guys, did he actually help you teach you harmony also?
No, he didn't. Not until later did Greg work with me on harmony, but he never worked with the Divines as a group on any harmony.
Okay. Do you remember some of the other like groups that were in school with you at the time? Like, were you in school with the Five Stair Steps at the time?
Yes, but they weren't in school when I was there. They were on the road, I believe. And they had tutors, and the Rotations were in school when I was there. The Specials, who used to be the Wonderfuls, they were there, and there were so many different acts. I can't think of everybody, but those two I definitely remember. They stand out in my mind.
Okay.
Because we were a little bit older, and we were all seeking more or less a professional entrance into the industry.
Okay. And then so did you guys all perform at the same like talent shows? Like, was there a Harlan talent show that you guys did?
Many. We did many Harlan talent shows. As a matter of fact, there was even one they had I called the Doug Jones Review that I put on myself. And I had a couple of other groups playing. The Specials didn't play on that one or the Rotations, but they were around. They were probably gigging somewhere else or something. But we used to do the talent shows at Harlan, and we'd go to we played at different nightclubs, Robert's Nightclub. We played the Grand Ballroom for New Year's Eve set one year, and played out at the Aragon. We played all over Chicago.
The Divines did, you're saying?
The Divines, yes.
So those are pretty big venues, actually. And you were just in high school at the time.
Yes.
So what was your act like?
Well, there were the three of us, and we were more in a formal style. We wore like tuxes, and Mildred was always very gorgeous. You know, she dressed divinely, we'll say.
Okay.
That was our style.
And I know, given that you were three guys and one woman, but you weren't a female lead male backup group like Gladys Knight and the Pips or something. Were you like inspired by the Miracles, or did you have your own kind of? Were you just accidentally end up that way, or were you?
We just ended up that way. That's how that came down.
Okay. So then how long were you together before the Divines, like how long were you guys doing shows and together before the Divines broke up?
A good 3.5-4 years.
Okay. Was it past, even past the time you graduated from high school?
No, we had broken up, before I left high school, right before, as a matter of fact, just about a year before I left high school, we broke up, and, I went on to further my career by submitting material to different companies around the city.
Okay. And I want to ask about that, actually, because on the Divines record, both sides I see are written by Chico, who I guess is Perry Wright. How did you get involved with songwriting?
I got involved in it. Well, I got Chico to played piano behind me and help write the music to some of my lyrics. And then when Greg was in town on vacation during one period with the Stair Steps, he and I ran into each other, and I said, "Hey, listen, I just wrote this lyric, and I'd like for you to check it out." And he came and he looked at it, and he pulled his guitar out and started playing his chords and singing the melody, and I picked up on it real quick, and we started singing it, and that was my true interim into being a songwriter, when Greg and I got together. And he and I really wrote my first song, my first real song together.
How old?
Which was a song called The New Love.
How old were you when you wrote your first song?
Oh, I'd say when I wrote my first song, unprofessionally, I'd say about 12 or 11. Professionally, my first song that I ever got a copyright on, I was 14.
Okay. So you had told me that you actually ended up working, so how'd you end up working professionally?
Well, I was coming home every day from Hyde Park High School. I used to take a couple of evening classes there, trying to keep my grades up because I was so distracted by music. But I used to have to take the Stony Island bus, and I would pass Kurtom every day. And one day I said, "I'm going over there and take my lyric and see what they have to say about it." So one day I did. I got off the bus. I had my lyric book with me. I went in, And I talked to Eddie Thomas, who was Curtis's partner at the time. And he looked over my lyric and he said, well, Curtis isn't in town right now, you know, but he'd probably be interested in seeing some of this. And, you know, why don't you come back by? And this was like around 67. Okay. Yeah. This was pretty close to 67 or in 67. And I did show up one day when Curtis was there. And I showed him, you know, my lyric when he had time to see me, that is. And there were a few things in there that attracted his attention. And so he asked me to come back by and, you know, try, you know, he asked me if I could put anything on tape and bring by to him. And I told him, you know, that I would do what I could, and I did. Greg and I made a tape of A New Love and something else, and I forget what it was, but anyway, I took it over and Curtis heard it, and he liked the feeling of it, and I used to sound a lot like Curtis when I'd sing, and I'm sure that not only humored him, but it, you know, probably made him feel good spiritually as well, knowing that someone was following him that closely. But
okay.
Excuse me. Anyway, after about 6 months, he told Eddie to get a writer's contract, a songwriter's contract for the company, and give to me to take home and have my parents look over. And Eddie gave me the contract. I took it home. I let my parents look it over. They refused to sign it. And I needed their signature because I was underage to just sign for myself. But they later, you know, gave in. And what happened was my mother gave in. And she said, okay, you know, I'm going to do this, you know, but it's up to you to keep your grades up and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure she had discussed it with my father before she did it. She didn't just do it behind his back. But she did go on and co-sign the contract for me, and I took it back to Curtis, and that was my first contract as a songwriter with the company.
And you were only 14 years old at the time, or 15?
I was going on 16, so it was like 66. It was going into the fall of 66. I was 16.
And where was the Kurtom Studios located at that time?
Kurtom, it wasn't a studio. It was just the offices.
Oh, just the offices.
And they were located on 85th and King, or Stony Island.
And was Curtis Mayfield usually that open to just like a 14-year-old walking in and showing him his songs? Or was it because you had connections with Greg Fowler and the Five Stair Steps already that you were able to get in? Like, why were you, was he that open-minded that he could, like, a 14-year-old could come in and just show him songs?
Curtis was a very open-minded person.
Okay.
He wasn't an easy person to get to, but I was a very tenacious person and persistent, and I was determined to get to him, and I did.
Okay. So that's cool that you must have been excited. So you had never met Curtis Mayfield before then, right?
I had never met him personally before then, no.
So I was
very excited.
He must have been one of your heroes at the time, too, and then you had to pitch your songs to one of your heroes. It must have been...
And he still is. He still is.
Yeah, it must have been difficult, like, to kind of... You have to sell something to somebody who's one of your heroes. I don't know if I could have done that.
Well...
So did they ever record or release any of the songs you wrote when you were there?
No, they didn't, but they perfected my career and perfected me as a lyricist. And Curtis, I remember one day he came in, and he never called me by my name. He never called me Doug or Douglas. He always called me Cat. And he came in, and I was sitting there, and I was working on some lyric, and he looks at me and he says, "Hey, Cat, how you doing?" I says, "Fine." He says, "I'll be with you in a few minutes." He says, "I've been out of town. Let me check on what's been going on, and then I'll take time to talk to you." So I said, "Okay, great." So I stuck around a couple of hours, and he finally had time to talk to me, and so he calls me into the office. He says, "Come on in, Cat, close the door." He says, "What you got for me?" So I sang a couple of things for him, a cappella, and he liked this one thing that I was doing. I was writing a thing called Mercy, 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 and this was before Marvin Gaye wrote his song Mercy. And the subject matter was a little bit different as well. But I got to this one part, and I sounded so much like Curtis. Like it was like he was looking in the mirror because he gave me this strange look, you know. And he said, "Wait a minute, stop." And he goes to the door, and he calls Eddie. He says, Eddie, come here for a minute. So Eddie comes into the office, Eddie Thomas, that is, and Eddie closes the door. He says, "Sit down, listen to this." He said, "Go ahead, Cat, blow that again." And so I did, and they both laughed at it and, you know, clapped five with each other. And Curtis said, "Okay, Cat," he says, "this is what you need to do." And he'd give me different pointers on, you know, how to perfect my songwriting, how to, you know, shorten the message and still be able to deliver a feeling. And he worked with me in that area quite a bit. So, and it was very effective.
So you got to work pretty closely with Curtis then, like every time he was in town, he would help you with your songwriting pretty much.
Most of the time, not every time, but most of the time.
And how often would you go to the studio? Would you go after school every day, pretty much?
I go to the office every day.
Okay.
Every day.
And, like, how many years were you employed as a songwriter there?
Well, I would say I was there for at least 2.5 years, close to 3 years. Okay. And then, after, you know, not making, any type of residual or anything, you know, which I was looking forward to, I figured I needed to venture out and, that I had enough experience under my belt that I could find, somebody that would be interested. And that's when I ran into Walter Jackson, and he wanted me to work with him as a songwriter, but, you know, there was no money there. But I still worked with him, you know, because it was only beneficial to me. And that was the whole thing. It was to better myself and make it a productive and conducive and lucrative as well situation.
So did you write any Walter Jackson records that were released?
No, I did not. But Walter worked with me very closely, and he worked with me daily for hours, you know, on phrasing and lyric and all. And Walter himself, being an excellent singer, you know, he was the right guy to do the job. And after that, I ventured down to 18th Street, around where most of the record companies were, and I ran into Fountain Records, which was Jerry Butler's company. And Calvin Carter was running the company at that time, and I had a couple of tapes by then, you know, with songs of mine on there, and I played a couple for Calvin, and he says, "Sure," he says, "we'd like to take you on as a songwriter," and I took him up on it. And I became a songwriter for Jerry Butler's company, Fountain Records. And at the time, Chuck Jackson, Jesse Jackson's brother, was a songwriter there. But Billy Butler, Jerry Butler's brother, was a songwriter there, and myself.
Did they have the writer's workshop yet, or was that later?
That was later.
Okay.
Okay. But it was, you know, there again, I didn't get any records out on Jerry, but I got a lot of experience, and knowledge is wealth in itself.
Okay, so the whole time you were kind of fine-tuning your skills as a songwriter.
Yes.
And while you were a songwriter at Kurtom, you were also a member of the Divines, is that right?
During the latter part of the Divines era, I was going to Kurtom, but we couldn't do anything because of the way Jerry Jones had the contracts written up. We were like tied down to him, and my parents had co-signed to that contract, but I couldn't do anything with the Divines and Curtis.
Okay, so Kurt, you're saying Kurtom actually might have signed you, but you couldn't because Jerry Jones' contract had you locked down.
I think if Curtis had heard the Divines as a group, I think that he would have taken interest.
Okay.
Because of the makeup of the group, the three guys and one girl. Even though he had the Stair Steps, which were four guys and one girl, but there was a much different sound there and
a different harmony.
And a totally different harmony. But everybody knew everybody.
So then, what did you do after you learned all this songwriting and worked for Kurtom and you worked for Walter Jackson and then you worked for Jerry Butler's Fountain Records? What did you do after that?
After that, I ran into James Miles, who we called Miles Gregory. He wrote the song "Love Don't Live Here Anymore" for Rolls Royce.
And he was in the rotations, right?
Miles used to be one of the rotations, correct. Miles and I came from nursery school together. Nursery school through high school into our professional careers. And he and I started writing together. And we were writing some nice things, and he told me one day he came by my place that he had gone by the night before to Joe Cash's house, who used to be a guitar player with the Rotations. And he had talked to Joe, about us maybe putting a group together.
So that was after the Rotations had broken up, right?
Yeah, the Rotations were no longer the Rotations. As a matter of fact, Joe had a group then, I think it was called Insight.
Okay.
But I went over to Joe's that evening, and he and Miles and myself, we were talking, and there's a knock at the door, and it's El Kiff, and El Kiff comes in and becomes a part of the conversation. Next thing you know, he's a part of the group, and next thing you know, we got a group.
You're talking about El Kiff Boston from the Rotations also?
Right. El Kiff used to be at the Rotations. It was Andrew Boston.
Okay.
And we came up with the name Father, and that was a name that we were blessed with. Why I cannot say and won't even venture to try to say, but the name was very appropriate. Greg always tells me that, when he thinks about Father, he thinks about Take Six, because that's what we reminded him of.
So what type of sound did you have?
We had very tight harmony, and we had a sound that would be close to, Take Six. I personally felt that our sound was close to, on the commercial level, I would say War or Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. That type of thing.
So were you a self-contained band at that point? Like, did you all play instruments?
We did not all play instruments. No, El Kiff and I did the vocals, and James Miles and Joe also did vocals. But James and Joe were guitar players. So we had two guitars and four voices.
Okay. And then you were still located in Chicago at that point, right?
Yes.
What year was that?
That was in 69, 70.
Okay.
And yeah, we're moving up. Yeah, that was 1970.
So are you saying you also had like a rock kind of sound because you were comparing yourself to like Crosby, Stills, and Nash? Like, were you like rock oriented in addition to R&B?
I won't say we were rock oriented, but we had a little rock flavor with us.
Okay.
Because we did have several other musicians that played with us. We had a guy named Rodney Clark on drums, who we used to call Rashid. We had Lawrence Dawson on keyboards, and we had Earl Powell, who was a guitar player. We had Buster playing bass. So that was Father, that was the group.
And
that's who all came to California.
Did Father play shows locally?
No, as a matter of fact, we didn't do any shows. All we did was Woodshed. We only worked to perfect, you know, what we were doing, and we wrote new material all the time.
And then what happened with Father?
We eventually were heard by a guy who was a road manager for War. We were introduced to him by a young lady named Nancy Cobb, who we went to high school with. And Nancy knew this guy named Ray, and she was telling us about him. He's War's road manager, and he's in town for a while. I want to check you guys out. So she had us over to her mother's house, and we're in our mother's basement, and Ray comes over, and he hears the group, and he immediately falls in love with the sound. And he says, I want to take you guys to California, and you think you'll be ready to go next week? And we'll be ready to go right now, you know, is our response. But we said, no, we need a couple of weeks. But, we're definitely interested. So a couple of months later, we packed up and headed towards California. And when we got to California, we went to Far Out Productions. It was after working hours. It was in the evening. It was after business hours. And Ray went over to the company, and somebody was there, you know, fun to talk to. And he goes in, and he comes back, and he's got a couple of checks in his hand. One to pay the hotel bill, and, you know, one for Wham, we call it walk around money. And they wrote these checks for him and gave them to him under the contingency that we wouldn't let anybody hear us or anything that we were doing before they did. And that was quite amazing to me in itself, you know, getting paid before I do anything.
Okay.
So,
And Far Out Productions was War's production company that they had.
That was the company. That's where Ray went to, Far Out Productions office, right on Sunset, across from the Guitar Center.
And that was War's production company, right?
That was War's production company. Well, it was really Eric Merton was the president of the company.
Okay.
And who was Jerry Goldstein, who I know you remember the record Hang On Sloopy.
Yeah.
They recorded in his mother's garage. And he was one of the executives at Far Out Productions. And Steve Gold, who handled a lot of the big artists. He handled Hendrix, and he handled us. And he had been around, you know, for quite a while, but the three of them, they were Far Out Productions. And they had, as their musical director, Joe Fazio, who was a very well-known guitar player, plays and does a lot of TV and a lot of movie things. But he was assigned as our producer.
Okay, so what happened? Did you end up recording for them?
We did. several demos. We did no master recording for them. We came into a little bit of a conflict of interest. They wanted one thing out of us, and we were willing to give part of the way, but not all of what they wanted were we willing to go through with. And at that point, we decided to sever our relationship. And this was like close to a year after we had signed with them. And we started more or less freelancing and shopping around to other companies. Motown at that time had moved to California. And, of course, there's A&M Records, and you got Warner Brothers. You got all the majors out there. And we went to them, knocked on their doors. I ended up at Frank Zappa's for a while as an independent, working as a songwriter, but never got anything out on Frank's label. But I did learn quite a bit just by paying attention around the office and learning the business. But and that was my important goal at that time, was learning the business and, you know, knowing what to do and how to further my career.
But so did father like unsuccessfully tried to go to all these other labels and fail to get a deal? Is that what happened?
Well, we went to several companies that did want to offer us deals, but the contingency that came along with it and the money, you know, and money is a major factor, you know, when it comes to survival. You know, everybody wants something for nothing. Okay, and it doesn't work that way.
Okay.
So, you know, what we started doing was we would take a couple of songs, we'd write a song here and there, and Miles and I, he and I took care of all the business for the company. We would take songs to the publishers, and we would get advance on some of the songs, and that was our survival money. We did pretty decent advances. I know we moved from Hollywood after we left for out, and after a few things didn't go right, and ended up staying out of one of my uncle's places out in Compton. But every morning, Miles and I would get up, and we would hitchhike over to the Harbor Freeway, and then we would walk down onto the freeway, and I don't know what would come into our minds, but it came and it worked. We'd do some kind of routine, and somebody or a couple of cars would always pull over to pick us up to see where we were going. And we'd tell them we were going to Hollywood, and they'd say, okay, jump in. You know, we just got in from Chicago, you know, and we're songwriters, and we have a group, and, you know, go through that conversation. And you know, I asked one of the guys one day, you know, I said, hey, you know, what made you pull over and pick us up? He says, you guys have a hell of a routine. He says, I don't know where you learned it from, but it works, you know. And so we did that for like almost 9 months, Miles and I. And like I say, every day, every morning by 9:30 at the very latest, you would see us on the Harbor Freeway with our thumbs out and doing some kind of choreography or some kind of routine. And we'd get picked up and we'd get a ride all the way to Hollywood. And we'd get out and we'd start hustling. We'd walk the pavement and we'd go from this company to that company to this company to that company. And a lot of people wanted the material. Very few people were interested in signing a new group, but everybody wanted, you know, a piece of this in some way or another.
So, did father eventually break up because you couldn't agree to the terms of all the deals you were offered? Is that what happened?
Yes.
So did most of the members of father go back to Chicago?
Most of them did. Miles, myself, and Joe, we stayed in California.
Because did you all wanted to focus on songwriting?
Well, we wanted to focus on the business, period. I mean, at this time, you know, we're getting older and, you know, this is our life. And it's something that we believed in, and we believed in ourselves.
Okay.
And
I was, sorry.
That's the first rule, you know, is to believe in yourself. And you find somebody that likes you as much as you like yourself, you got it made.
And obviously, Gregory Miles had the big hit with Rose Royce, ultimately.
Yes.
So going back to your story, you said your first kind of writing work in California was working at Frank Zappa's office. Is that right?
Yeah, I was up at Frank Zappa's company for a few months, you know, and it got kind of wild up there, you know, Henry Gold and those guys, you know, and but I was able to learn things about the industry itself, you know, just by paying attention and listening to the conversation that would be held around the office. And, you know, so I didn't leave with a pocket full of money, but I left with a head full of knowledge.
Okay. And then where did you work at a bunch of as a writer at a bunch of other companies?
I worked as a songwriter at several different other companies. Well, like I said, you know, we would give advances on publishing on songs. For instance, Miles and I, we have quite a few songs, and Greg and I also have quite a few songs in Motown in Joe Bett's catalog. You know, they are very meticulous. You know, Robert Gordy was over the publishing company, and of course, you know, Barry ran the company himself, but his brother Robert ran the publishing, and he liked our style of songwriting, but we would never sign as a staff writer because we wanted the freedom to be able to go where we wanted to. And if something better or bigger came along, we wanted to be available to take advantage of it.
Okay. So did they ever record anything that you wrote at Motown?
As a matter of fact, I heard one of the songs that Greg and I wrote. I'm flipping the channel on the TV one day, and I get to the station, and I hear this tune, and I'm singing it to myself, and all of a sudden I realize, I say, hey, that's my tune. Well, one of the major stores that's across the country was using this tune in their commercial, and I immediately called my attorney, and I got hold of the publishing company and, you know, trying to find out, you know, how did they get a hold of the song, you know, and what's the deal that they're playing the song, you know, I'm not seeing it on my residuals. And that's something that's even still to this day being worked on, and that's been going on for a few years now. But it, you know, it's like a battle to the finish, and I'll be here fighting it to the finish.
But it was one of the it was one of the Joe Bett songs that was in the TV commercial.
Yes.
Okay.
One of the songs we had sold to Joe Bett. Well, we didn't sell to, but you know, we
published with
him. You see, and publishing is a whole different entity of the business, but it's one of the biggest and major entities of the business. Because that's where all your music is controlled through. So they had access to the catalog, I guess, and they heard the tune, and it was attractive to them, and they used it and didn't think about who they were getting it from, you know, why they were getting it.
But either way, Joe Bett should have paid the writers, but they didn't, so.
Oh, absolutely. And they will. You know, it's just a matter of time.
So around 76, a bunch of stuff started happening for you, right? Like 75, 76?
A lot of stuff, yeah. Things really started to turn over for me.
So one thing that you did was you produced an album, isn't that right?
Yes, my brother and I produced an album on the group Crystal Brandy. My brother Horace Jones, he's in the movies now. And he calls me about doing theme songs for his movies, Greg and I. But he and I produced an album on Crystal Brandy. My brother got the budget together and did all the legwork himself. And the album came out very nice, a little bit ahead of its time, but it was still a very nice album.
So who was Crystal Brandy?
Crystal Brandy was Didi Thomas, Robert West. I forget Sam's last name, but Sam was the drummer, and Greg Fowler.
Okay. So Greg Fowler was actually a member of a group again.
Yes. And before that, Greg was with Baby Huey and the Babysitters, and, you know, he had worked with many groups, and he had been on the road. He used to do a lot of Brunswick tours, you know, playing behind the Artistics and various groups that were with Brunswick.
Okay, I didn't know that. He was part of the Brunswick backing band, you're saying?
Yeah, well, he wasn't, like, under contract with them, but everybody wanted him.
Okay.
So he would go out on the road with the Artistics and other groups.
So he must know Larry Blazingame pretty well.
I'm sure.
So this Crystal Brandy project that you put together, you produced it yourself, and yeah. you recorded it in California, is that right?
We recorded it at the record plant, yeah.
And you recorded a whole album, and then did the album get released?
The album did get a deal. We were first offered a singles deal off the album with Capitol Records. And my brother said, no, you know, we want to get a deal for the entire album, not just one song, you know, or two songs. And he had a lot of connections through the BBC, which he had done a lot of work for. And he had done documentaries and various things for the BBC. And he had a contact that put us in touch with people in Canada. The guy was president of RCA, John Williams. And John left RCA and went to Columbia as president in Canada. And he heard the Crystal Brandy thing, and they threw us up immediately to talk business. They didn't want to talk over the phone. They wanted to talk face-to-face. So John and his partner, Gary, has to come to Canada, and we consummated the deal. And after that, we went in, we mixed Crystal Brandy. And during that time, I'd like to mention also, we had the opportunity of producing the background singers for Bette Midler, who used to be called Gotham, and they changed their name to Hennessy. And this is three white guys who they could compete with the Pointer Sisters very well.
Okay.
They were very tight.
So that was also mid-70s around that time also?
That was during the same era, yeah.
So you signed a record deal with RCA Canada, is that right?
Right. Well, excuse me. We signed our deal with John and Gary's company, but John ran the material. He took everything through RCA in Canada, I believe, and he also released it independently. And that we're unable to track down.
So did he actually put out the album or just release a single?
Yes. No, he put the album out.
Okay, so he actually released a whole album by Crystal Brandy, but it's really rare because he released it independently. And,
yeah.
And you said he also released a single possibly off the album?
Yes. But you understand that in Canada, it's a whole different format, you know, where we have states here, they have provinces there, and they have 10 provinces, and aside from Canada, you know, you've got Brazil, and you've got many other countries around the world that records can be released in, and if you don't have the proper licensing, you know, it's very difficult to keep up with.
Okay, so you have no idea what happened with it, is what you're saying.
After that, no, I don't.
Okay, well, either way, we have a copy of the album here, which pretty much no one has heard. And there's a like the whole album is really solid, but there's a track that I really like a lot that I'd like to play, if that's okay. It's called Remedy. Is that okay that I play it?
Yeah, Remedy wasn't on the album. I will say that. Okay, Remedy is a song that Greg and I wrote.
But
I had that especially sent to you just because I like the song, and I felt that you would like it. You did mention another song that you liked on the album, which is my personal favorite.
Keep Smiling.
You got it.
Do you want me to play that instead?
I want you to play whatever you want to play. I want to make the people happy.
Okay. I'll play Remedy, and then at the end of the show, I'll play Keep Smiling, if that's okay.
That's your choice.
Okay. I'll play Remedy right now, and then it's kind of long. I'll fade it maybe halfway so we don't run out of time, and then we can talk some more.
That sounds great.
Okay, great. So this is Crystal Brandy with Remedy.
With me, baby.
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. Right now playing is a group called Crystal Brandy, which is written and produced by a person I have on the phone right now, Doug Jones, who was originally from Chicago and who sang in a group called The Divines. So, Doug, who's singing lead on this record?
Greg Fowler and Dee Dee Thomas.
Okay.
Are the lead singers on the Remedy, and there was another song on there, I Knew You Win.
Okay. Yeah, the whole album was pretty solid all the way through, and but this wasn't, this track wasn't even on the album. You were telling me you had done this a little bit later with the group.
No. We did that later. That was recorded at H.B. Barnum Studio.
Okay. And, yeah, it's too bad that it never got released just because it was, like, really excellent material. And plus, it was probably one of the first times that Greg Fowler was actually on rec, because he had been behind the scenes through so much music and through, like, the Five Stair Steps career, but, like, actually up front and singing on a record, probably one of the first times. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. But Greg was a fabulous singer. He used to sing smoother than Curtis Mayfield, and all of a sudden he got this growl in his voice, and he went to the David Ruffin style.
Okay. So that record kind of fell through because of what happened with the Canada distribution deal. Like, you don't know what happened, but is that right?
For the most part, yes.
So then you went on and, you still went, your songwriting kind of took off more though, didn't it? Like, what happened after that with your songwriting?
Yes. After that, I met a guy, Chuck Davis, who was, producing Donald Byrd and the Blackbirds and Bobby Humphrey, the most profound jazz flautist in the world, that, in my opinion. And, he was working on this music for a song for Bobby Humphrey's album. And he asked me if I had any ideas for it. And I said, yeah. And so he's playing, and so I started singing the melody for him. And then I came to the hook line, the trip. The trip was it, but the ride was nowhere. And that really, you know, like, made his ears stand up. And he said, that's it, it's the trip. And the melody that I wrote is very close to the melody that Bobby plays on the album. The trip is, it's a trip. But, from that, and I was in the studio one night with, the Stair Steps and Billy Preston, and, the session was over and I was leaving, and Billy was playing something on the piano. And I sang this line to what he was playing. And the next morning, my wife says, you got a phone call. And I said, who is it? She said, Billy Preston. I said, okay. And I took the call, and Billy says, are you working right now? And I says, yeah. You know, because a songwriter's always working.
Yeah.
But he says, I mean, are you working on any projects at this time? And I said, no. He says, how would you be interested in being my co-writer? And I said, that sounds interesting. Yeah. You know, he says, I'll send someone to pick you up. You know, I want to talk to you. So he did. And they took me on to Kendon Studios. And before the Stair Steps came in and all, Billy and I sat and talked. And he asked me about being his lyricist. And I took him up on it. The funny thing about it, though, is when I got to the studio and walked in, Billy was playing the song, and he was singing that line that I was singing the night before. And I said, oh, it must have been a good line. You know, it stuck with him, you know. It's got a hook. So we wrote that song, and that was the first song Billy and I wrote, a song called Give Thanks. And from there, we wrote together for 28 years.
So your songs were actually released on Billy's record, right?
Yes.
What was the first album that
the first album was titled Billy Preston, and the song that they took off there was I've Got the Spirit.
Okay.
And there's another song on there called Take Time to Figure It Out.
And
go on.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, you didn't. I'm sorry.
Okay, so there's two songs on that album that were released by Billy Preston that you wrote.
Correct.
And then were there more Billy Preston songs that you wrote that were released on future albums?
Yes, there was a song called Give Thanks. There was another song, To Be Praised. Oh, my God. I wish you told me that you needed to know these songs because I would have made a list of them.
Well, that's fine. But
Billy and I we have a nice catalog together.
So did you?
I will say that.
Did you co-write
a very thick catalog?
Did you co-write them with Billy, or did you write them yourself mainly?
No, I co-wrote them with Billy. I was his co-writer. I was his lyricist.
Okay. And so the first thing that you ever wrote that really came out was Bobby Humphrey's material on Bobby Humphrey's The Trip on her Fancy Dancer album. Is that right?
Yes.
And then you ended up writing stuff that came out on Billy Preston's records.
Yes.
And did you work exclusively with Billy Preston for like the last, you said 20 years?
28 years we wrote together.
Okay.
And we wrote a lot of songs over those 28 years. We didn't get all of them released, but quite a few of them did get Preston released on different albums that I even personally don't have copies of, but people have told me that they've heard them and they've seen them, but I have yet to get a hold of the publisher to get a hold of copies of them because a lot of companies have gone through transitions with their publishers, you know, and different companies doing their licensing. So, you know, I've put in requests for copies of songs to be sent to me, and they're searching them down, and, you know, every now and then I'll receive a copy of this or that, you know, from Universal, who is primarily in most of the company's licensing to know.
Okay. And so what did you do after working with Billy?
I did a lot of freelance writing and producing, and I created a situation for myself called Navigator. Yesterday's Thrill with Today's Feel. And I created a company called Navigator Productions USA, and I named myself the Navigator.
Okay, and what song have you released anything?
I released a couple of songs. I was the first one to write a tribute to Princess Di when she was killed, and then I also wrote a tribute to Mother Teresa, and I have an album out, myself and Joe Cash, produced on me called, Navigator. And, that's one album that you didn't receive a copy and I bet you get it tomorrow.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's never too late. But, you know, you'll find that, Navigator was, a little bit of ahead of its time because right now we're able to go back and take some of those songs, pull them out, polish them up, and we've got companies that are right now interested in, you know, using this material for theme songs for movies and songs in movies, as well as we've even got a couple of companies that want to buy into our catalog just to do some re-releases.
Okay. And you had asked me, so should we play the Princess Di song right now?
If you could play part of it, it would be nice.
Okay, let's play this.
Mother Teresa, Princess Di, they're both wonderful women.
Okay, let's play part of the Princess Di song and then talk some more.
Okay.
So this is called, the group is called the DAG Connection, is that right?
No, the DAG Connection, that's Greg at my company. The group is called Navigator.
Okay.
That's me. Because I'm doing all the vocals on everything.
Okay, so this is Navigator.
But it's Joe Cash and myself are Navigator.
Okay, and Greg Fowler also wrote this song, right?
Yeah, Greg is on that song as well. Greg and I write everything together.
Okay, so this is Princess Di's Last Ovation.
Yeah. Oh, Princess Di, no, that's Joe Cash also. I'm sorry. So let me leave Joe out. Okay. Joe is on Princess Di as well.
Okay, so it's Doug, Greg, and Joe on this track.
Right.
Okay, here it is.
We bow out of another occasion. Join me in giving Princess Di's last ovation. Clap your hands,
she's
so amazing. Such the sensation. Out of respect, no obligation. This is Princess Di's last ovation. Clap your hands softly together. Everyone, to your hat and a feather. Hear this all over the world. For the princess.
Okay, playing right now is Navigator with Princess Di's Last Ovation, and on the phone right now is Doug Jones, member of the Chicago group The Divines, and he's singing lead on that record, and you could definitely hear what he was talking about before, where he has a similarity to Curtis Mayfield in his voice. At least to me, it sounds very Curtis-influenced. I don't know if you would agree, Doug.
I do.
Okay.
Curtis is a very big influence on my vocals.
Okay. So so that song, did you actually release it? Like, did you press it up and put it on a CD?
We pressed it up. We put it on a CD. I tried to get an independent release on it. I did get some play on it. As a matter of fact, there were talk stations in California that would play it, and talk stations usually do nothing but talk. But they would actually play Princess Di, and they played Mother Teresa during the periods of time, you know, that would come around during the year that they both were deceased. And I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, it's definitely a nice cut. Like it's got a nice kind of modern but throwback sound also. Very soulful. So what have you been doing since then?
Since then, I've been working on theme songs for various movies. I've been receiving movie scripts from Joe Pantera, who's the guy who played in The Shield. He's also a movie producer, and he's a performance producer as well, because he's got a big show that he's putting on with Paul McCartney and Smashing Pumpkins and all coming in July. But he's got several movie scripts that he's got me working on theme songs for, and my brother has couple of movies in the hopper that he's working on, that he's got Craig and I working on theme songs for. So primarily we've been working on theme songs for movies and fillers for that, and I've been working a lot with my son, Doug Jr.
Have you gotten anything placed in any movies yet?
Oh, yeah, the songs are placed. It's just that they're under working titles, and they haven't completed the editings, and they aren't ready for release yet. I look forward to them coming out in the coming year.
Okay. And then have you released any more material on Navigator or on your own yet?
No.
Okay.
No, I've just been working on material. I'm ready to go in and record something else on Navigator, probably in about another, somewhere between the next 6 to 8 months, I'll probably do something else on Navigator. And that I look forward to getting a much bigger response to.
So we have a track here called Changes. What is that recorded recently?
Choices,
sorry. Was that recorded recently?
Choices will take you through changes, though.
Okay. Was Choices recorded recently?
Choices was recorded a couple of months ago. Greg and I, as a matter of fact, we recorded that. Believe it or not, we recorded it at home, just putting it down to test before we went into the studio and did the actual recording of it. So I sent you the rawest copy because I get this certain feeling from the rawness, you know.
It sounds nice,
that,
though.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Once it goes through the studio, it goes through so many different processes. Now I'm giving the people an opportunity to hear what it sounds like when we first put it together before it goes to the studio.
Okay, well, I think as the last track, we're going to play this Choices track. So first of all, I have to say thanks so much for being on the phone and telling your story. I really appreciate it. You had a really interesting story taking us through both sort of the South Side of Chicago and the music business and how it was back then, all the way to the music business in California and how it is today. So it was a very interesting and enlightening story.
And well, I want to thank you very much for having me, and I want to thank everyone in the world, especially those of you in Chicago who supported me. And I always give thanks to my God, who supports us all, and without him, there would be none of us. But I thank everyone for everything as far as their assistance in my career, and I pray that we all continue to be strong and go on the straight path and do the right thing.
That's definitely good advice. So this last track that we're going to play is it's Navigator, and this track is called Choices.
God bless you.
Choose love. Choose love. Choose.